This is a Pinball News production.
Hello, thanks for having me. I've only given one talk before at a pinball show, which was at Seattle. No particular reason. I guess I didn't have anything to say, and then the guys in Seattle kind of gave me some ideas, so I was able to put together a deck. And then Rob asked, you know, come to Pinball Expo, so I said, no problem. And it's kind of Retro Future is the title. You know, I kind of look to the past to kind of design the future and you know, move forward that way. And I've done some games. And pinball. So people ask kind of like, why do you do pinball? Because I design lots of things, and I've been doing pinball for a long time. And some of the games I've done, you know, Circus Voltaire, Theater Magic. I haven't done a whole lot of games, but, you know, they've been, you know, pretty good games. Star Wars Episode One. I work for a toy company called Zizzle, and we did a lot of home games. So we did two-thirds size pinball machines that were pretty cool. And then I've been doing a lot of stuff for the iPad, iPhone, apps, educational for kids. And I have some new full-size games working on, which I'll talk about. But when I was young, at age of six, I was a do-it-yourselfer, a modder, and a hacker. And I built things like this. And our main components were, you know, clothespins, balls, steel, kind of pins, scotch tape, and rubber bands. And so at 6 years old, this is what we were doing. And kind of at age 10, I got the spirit, the pinball spirit. I played hockey, you know, growing up in Canada, and all the hockey arenas had pinball machines. So games like Gulfstream, we would play them over and over and kind of, you know, get the pinball kind of vibe and kind of got addicted at that age. So at age 6, we weren't quite knowing what we were doing, but at age 10, it kind of hit in. And at age 14, I was kind of the wizard. Watched the Magnificent Marble Machine at lunch coming home from school. And Captain Fantastic was kind of the game that was everywhere that we got to play just before Wizard came out. Then I got my first book, Illustrated History, from the Bay in Toronto for like $7. And we cut them up and put them all over our walls like posters. Great book. And then Roger Sharp's book came out. So the pinball book was kind of like, you know, Pinball Flash, but it didn't really make any sense. Roger's book connected the industry and the faces. And it was like, there are all these people in Chicago and these big factories making games, having all this fun, and all over the world. Because Roger's book, you know, he took pictures and he wrote about arcades all over the world. And it was like, wow, this pinball thing is really big. And so then I got kind of the bug to get involved in the industry, which is kind of real nutty. But all of this together, from age 6 to age 14, 15, it kind of created this reality, this impression of pinball. So when I look at pinball, this is kind of what I see. And I guess Dave Christensen's artwork really is kind of the epitome of the look. But it's these beautiful, glamorous games and really interesting people kind of looking out at you, very colorful games, very well illustrated, and just, you know, just really inspiring. And so when I look at pinball, you know, this is kind of what I see from my impression from an early age. And inside, this is my inner animal spirit. I'm like a squirrel. You know, squirrel gets up early, and his whole day he just looks for things to eat and avoid predators, kind of stay out of hot water. And you know, the squirrel is looking for the nut, but, you know, to me the nut is like the banana split. So when I'm out looking for opportunities and designing pinball, I'm trying to find the banana split, kind of the real juicy thing. But you know, my inner heart is the heart of the squirrel. So people that know me, kind of this makes sense. And then I wrote a letter to Norm Clark. In the back of Roger's book, he put these nice photographs of like Sam Stern and Norm Clark and some other industry veterans. And it was like, you know, I'm going to write Norm because I was working for an operator at the time and I knew how to fix games, I could troubleshoot, you know, read schematics, all that type of stuff. So I thought, well, I'm going to go work at Bally. That's where I want to work. And so I wrote Norm, 2640 West Beaumont Avenue. Michael Hanley saw the letter from Norm. And so this is Norm in his office. And so Norm, he made a big mistake in the letter. He wrote the letter, thank you for writing, here's some stickers. And then he said, if you're ever in Chicago, come and visit me. So it was like he made a mistake. And on the letter, I showed Mike yesterday, and on the bed, you know, it says, when you're ever in Chicago, please visit me. So I booked my flight, and I went 2 weeks later. I went, like, instantly to see Norm. And so Norm made a big mistake inviting me out, because I was like a pain in his butt. And at that time, we went to the Bally Pinball Division. It was in Bensonville, Illinois. It was just built when I was there. It was maybe 2 years old. It was just gigantic factory just to make pinball machines. This sign here, like if you're a person, you're kind of like this big on the sign. This sign was huge on 90 O'Leary Drive. And the other mistake Norm made is he let me take a camera in the factory. So I may be the only person that was ever allowed to take photos inside the pinball division being invited for a tour. And at this time, they were making 8-Ball Deluxe. And it's another game back here. I don't remember what it was, but at that time, it was just this gigantic factory, one assembly line, you know, one end, and then all the stuff would go to the other end. And so I walked around with my camera. It was a disc camera, so it wasn't very good. And they had a back box line. They would build all the back boxes, let them burn in for one day, so this would be production for the next day. It was always like one day ahead, all the boards. And of course, the testers, we've seen those. And he's got the groovy shirt on, and so you can kind of tell when it was. Early 80s. 500 games a day they made on one line. So this is a cable line. So it was pretty amazing. And the factory must have been, I don't know, you know, 500 feet long or four, just huge factory. And it would start at one end and then go to the other end. So it was time to say goodbye. So here's Norm. See, he's smiling. You know, get rid of this kid. He's going. Going to lunch at Monty's Steakhouse across, kind of across the street from where the pinball division is. But, you know, Norm made, like, the third mistake is he's taking me back. And then I told him, well, I'm not going back. And he goes, well, what do you mean? And we're having, like, we're finishing dinner. And he's like, what time is your flight? And I said, well, I'm not going back. He goes, what do you mean? I go, you have to hire me. I want to work here at the pinball division. And so he hired me. He hired me on the spot at lunch, told me how much I'm going to make. I went back to Toronto, got my stuff. I was back 2 weeks later to start. But he hired me in pinball engineering. I started in pinball engineering. So, and I told him, I just want to work in the factory. And he says, oh, no, I'll put you in engineering because you know how to solder and take apart games and things like that. And then I met all these new friends. And some of them you may know, you know, Tony Ramone, Margaret Hudson, you know, Kevin O'Connor, Pat McMahon's back there, Pete Gustafson. And we were just like a bunch of kids. And it was, you know, it was pretty cool. And they gave me a closet for an office. I had I bugged them and bugged them. I got to have an office. I can draw and all this type of stuff. And this is Destroyer. This is like one of my first Whitewoods. And we all drew by hand. And then this game, I had my office for a while. And then they another designer came to share my office. And his name was Dennis Nordman. And this was a game Dennis brought in. So we shared the office. And Dennis talked on the phone all day. So it was very hard to work to do that. And back then, we drew all our games by hand, pencil on Mylar. So this is a game called Tornado. So this is a game that was never made. We had a super secret, like a super double secret project that I was working on, Greg Kamik, and I think maybe Gary Gayton. And these were games that had kind of hoods on them, and you would walk into the game, and it was called Environmental Pinball. So mine was like a Wizard of Oz game. And this was, it had like a big tornado and lightning clouds and all sorts of stuff. And then the funnel, the ball would drop here. And you can see the ramps ending here, that they would get sucked up into the tornado. So this was, you know, 1981. It was pretty crazy. And so this is a Destroyer, kind of a closer view. But we were taught to build everything by hand, meaning back there they had, not internships, they had apprenticeship programs. So the designer, you were in charge of your design, and you had to build everything. So if you had wire ball guides, you had to solder them yourself. If you had metal ball guides, you had to rivet them. I think the wood panel was the only thing that we would get. But in a lot of cases, you know, we would route those by hand. The designer would get the router and kind of route it out. But there was a big problem. Norm had this credenza. And so in this case, I'm coming in. I say, Norm, I have this great idea for a magnet thing. And he's like, yeah, okay, you know, hoser. I've seen this. And he would open up this drawer from his credenza. And he had the stack of drawings and papers, like, from the last 40 years of his pinball career. And he would, like, hold it up, and he'd say, look, I thought of that in 1952. And he would hold it up. And And I would like go back to my office kind of like, you know, because I thought it was, I was the first one, and he did it all the time. And I guess he did it to everyone. I wasn't the only one that he did it to. He did it to everyone, so. And so we worked away at Bally, and but we were kind of a little bit in, like, the guys at Williams, you know, we had all the pinball companies were busy at the time, and we weren't allowed to have dinner, you know, go out for lunch, things like that. So we were kind of in our camps. We hung around the Williams guys a little bit at nighttime. Some of the artists would hang around and that. But generally, we were kind of on our own. And, you know, we worked and worked. And then around 98, just before 98, we were at the show, and we had Blackwater 100, sold 3,000 games. We had Lost World by Dan Langlois, 1,000. And Williams had Cyclone at this show. And I remember we set up the show, and it was 10 o'clock, and like at 10:05, you know, we walk over to look at the new Williams game. And it was like everybody was coming back like dejected, and it's like, and they were like, you know, you should see this game, and Cyclone sold around 10, a little under 10, but it was at that point we knew we were defeated. That's the, and I used the best one, the Pinball Masters. So it had changed. Bally and Williams had changed. We were no longer the masters at that point, and they had drawn the sword from the anvil. If you can come up with an analogy, they had pulled it out and were king now. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. And ultimately, we learned a lot of playfield junk does not a good game make. There's so many other items that make a good game. And so it all stopped in 88. I was at Williams a little bit, and then I was let go and went back to doing other things. And but learned a valuable lesson on, you know, how to design pinball. And the guys at Williams, the time I was there before, they brought Bally guys over. Some guys stayed, some guys were let go. I learned a lot about how not to design games, the way that I'd been taught at Bally, because Bally, we had kind of a different style. So, and we were all looking at the real kings. So we you know, it changed at that point, and it was the guys at Williams did it the best. And so if you want to be the best, you have to just, you know, kind of rethink everything you're doing. So time went by, and I was doing other things. And then how I got my job at WMS, because WMS was kind of an amalgamation now of Williams, and they had bought Bally and, you know, some other companies, and Capcom was starting. And Jim Patlin called. And he would go, "You got any games?" And pinball designers are always making something. So he goes, "You got any games ready?" I go, "Yeah, I got four." So this is just one of them, and you can see drawings in the back. This is my studio in Toronto. And so on Alice in Wonderland, it was a small group of us that made it. And Mike Hanley here helped, and I did it, and a few other people. This game had 26 new features on it. You know, we had neon lighting, and we had kind of this lower kind of optical play field, you know, new bottom arch, balls jumping over, all this really cool original stuff. And I went back to the Italian bottom. So I've learned to stay the Italian bottom works good. I don't put bumpers in between flippers and move them and do things like that, like the other designers. So they hired me, basically. You know, "Do you want to come to Williams?" And I said, "Sure." And we did you know, 3 or 5 game deal. You know, I'm not going to come and do one game. It's a waste of time. So if you guys want me to come, let's set up a good deal. I'll work very hard, and the games will do very well. So we came up to something that worked. And we brought all this stuff. And this was in my office when I went to WMS. And then I met Jack. So at Williams, you were partnered with an engineer. Jack Scalin had come off a game with Mark Ritchie before. And, you know, engineers and designers are different. Engineers, you know, they think one way, designers are another way. So it took us a little while to figure out how each other worked. And Jack was a great engineer. And actually, you know, I'm doing Magic Girl now, so it's the first game I'm doing without Jack. So it's very hard because I'm used to relying on him for advice and help me with brackets and look at mechanics. But Jack was a great engineer. And yeah, he passed away about 2 months ago. And then I got an office, so this is kind of what my office would look like. And, you know, put all my junk around. And this is stuff for Tales of Arabian Nights. You can see we had different genie targets. And originally the target would kind of go up and down like those old shooting gallery games and kind of keep all that stuff around. But what I brought is a CAD skill set. So World Cup was the first game drawn in CAD, 2D AutoCAD. Dan Langlois and I at Bally, they would give us money to buy all this CAD software. So him and I were the two artists or two designers at Bally doing CAD. So in this case, with World Cup, I brought a CAD library, basically, that I created. And so World Cup went from start to prototype in 6 months, which at that time was half of the normal time. We saved the company a lot of money, and actually in engineering it went pretty well. Here's some early Whitewoods, early foam model, so you can see the Alice game in my office. This is an early Magic of David Copperfield. So Theater Magic originally started out as Magic of David Copperfield, but we had trouble with the license, so we had to kind of move on. So here we have the Vanishing Girl, the Death Saw, and we had some other things. So we had to change it kind of quickly, some other RAM configurations. The way I design, I don't do like a 2D CAD drawing and then go to Whitewood. I do sketches on a small piece of paper, and then I'll build these big foam maquettes just by hand cut and make the ramps and do all that. And from that, in my mind, I can figure out how everything's going to lay three-dimensionally, and then I'll take that data and then go into CAD. Because CAD's a tool, so you can't really design a good game in CAD. I'll do it all this way, build these foam models. And in a lot of cases, we'll hook flippers up and shoot the game if somebody says, well, that's, you know, this shot's not going to work. So we'll do that. But the game originally had these lanterns on it, which was pretty cool. We had the eagle lanterns from the statue or the Empire State Building all inside the game to light up the cabinet, but we had to yank those because of cost savings. So, but you can see them, the first foam one had them on. It's pretty cool. It also had the Magic Wand ramp. We did not copy the Capcom ramp. Originally, we had it on the skill shot, and then we had it on the ramp on the left, but it didn't work really good. The ball would wobble, it would get magnetized. Sometimes it wouldn't fall off the end of the wand. And at WMS, we were taught if you're having any trouble with your mechanisms, you need to fix it immediately or get it off the game, because there's no way you can have a whole factory full of games and have some parts breaking, or you have a new game that's being shipped and parts are breaking. You know, it was not allowed to happen. So as a designer, you had to assess your engineering really quick, and someone would say, you know, man, that doesn't work. You need to take it off your game, or you need to fix it like today. And so in that case, it didn't quite work. Out it came. So here's some back glass. Actually, David Copperfield game was pretty far along. We had a play field drawn. We had three or four cabinet concepts, back glass, and then it all stopped. And we took a couple days off, and then we came up with, we're going to do Hocus Pocus for a while. It was an old Bally game, but we changed. And kind of off we went. And everybody has kind of a dream game. So that's being a pinball designer. You know, everybody can design one really good game. And then Jim Patlow would always challenge me. He'd go like, well, what about your next game? And because doing game number two is hard, doing game number three is hard, game number four is hard. And that really tests the mettle of the designer. Or the design team, because at Williams we had design teams, so the designer was not the only creative person on the team. So here's some other sketches. This was the original painting for the cabinet. And Linda Deal, amazing artist. She did Doctor Who, and then kind of nobody wanted to work with her for whatever reason, and we're like, you know, your portfolio is amazing, so we had her do to join our team on Theater Magic, and this is the painting. She's just kind of finishing it up, all hand done. Pretty amazing work. And we stayed together as a team. And here's Cameron. So there's the Circus Voltaire Whitewood. This is in Jim Sherd's lab. Jim Sherd ran he was the manager of the prototype lab. And we like to take pictures for some reason. And some people said, well, it's because, you know, of your hair, and you want to take pictures of your hair. And it was like, we just wanted to take pictures because it was, you know, they were kind of moments for us, really important moments. So starting to build the first Whitewood is a really pivotal, you know, part of the process. And in this case, for those that know Circus Voltaire very well, this game is really different. And you'll notice the playfield inserts here. We had the Dracula, the Mist Magnet assembly in this one, and the ball would come down on a wire form, it would drop in front of the slingshot, and it would be grabbed, and then it would go up the playfield. And then we'd kind of shake and start out for multi-ball. So, and we had some other features. Looks like some kick-out holes, saucers down here. But again, you know, in that case, we removed that because we were afraid the playfield was going to warp. Anytime you cut a slot in a playfield is usually not a good idea. If it's all the way through or all the way underneath, it's going to warp. In this case, we had all these inserts and this kind of big undercut. And again, it's the you know, the engineering manager would come and is like, you know, I think that's going to warp, and we would talk about it. And if there's any thought that there would be a problem later in production or for customers, you know, you got to yank the thing out of the game. So in that case, that $35 mechanism was yanked out. So here's a little better shot of it. So you can see where it would drop here and go down and move up. But what we tried to do is, you know, we always tried to save money. And in this case, we had a wood ramp. So we would cut the wood out of the end of the play field to try and save money. But the ball didn't stay on. It would just kind of go up the ramp and fly off into the back of the game. So again, we had to yank it off. It didn't work. And we had inserts on the ramp, which was pretty cool. But circus stayed pretty well the same for the most part. The disappearing jet bumper, you know, that was Jim Sherd's idea. So we were going over the drawing one day, and I was saying, you know, Jim, I really want to get a cluster of three bumpers down low, but there's no room. I don't want to block all these shots. And then Jim goes, well, why don't you make one go up and down? And we're like, and just at the time, Steve Kordek had a game in his room that had the, I think it was called Gusher, that had the bumper that went up and down. And it was like Gusher. But we didn't want to use the motor, so we did it on the coil. But that's a great example of working as a team. So having Jim, you know, say, hey, you know, you can do this. And then we, you know, Jack made the mechanism pretty quick to see if it would work. And, you know, it turned out to be pretty good. There's Mark Lena, kind of testing. The first circus, Whitewood, we had this big kind of wood back box thing, kind of like 300, you know, the games with the balls. And we had a real bell and you know, it was bonus. And it was really cool. But, again, too expensive. And we didn't have time to engineer it, so out it came. And here we are in production. And I'm smiling, but I'm really not happy because when you're in production, this was sample run, it's very stressful because you have all these parts coming in and the guys are trying to box the games and you have to make sure they work. And literally every single game, you have to go. And then if you have a sample game, you'll notice on the bottom, you'll see my signature on every of the first like 200 of any of my games. You'll see my signature kind of on the bottom. To do that, you see a different color neon. Each one had a different color neon, and so it was pretty cool. But you know, Jack and I were always in the factory at Williams, and they liked us there because we'd be there 6 a.m, and we would stay all day till the line closed, until samples were done. In production, we go maybe 2 times a week for any issue, so they could resolve the issues. Because if the line is stopped, it's really bad. But we always did pinball stuff. There's Duncan Brown and Jim Shelberg. And we bought the Harlequin from the Bally Building downtown from a gentleman in Michigan. And then now it's been donated to Tim Arnold in Las Vegas. So hopefully he'll put it up one day. But it's 17 feet high. It's you know, it's as big as this wall. It's really cool. And there's King Arthur. So he's in all the games I make. He's a magical cat. And then pinball started to kind of, you know, go down and games weren't selling. And they went to all the designers. You know, kind of, what are you going to do? And guys were making all different kind of different kooky type games. And when I came to Williams, I had games that had LCD panels on the play field or in the back box, different things that I'd show Jim when he came to my studio the first time. Showed him Alice in Wonderland, and then I had some other games that I worked on. And they kind of said, you know, you need to revive those games. And I said, nah, you know, I'm done. And so I sat for 3 weeks in my office and did nothing, while all the other designers were doing all these games with ping pong balls and kind of goofy stuff. And then finally we built the first prototype for Pinball 2000, which had a big LCD back box and, you know, big stereo speakers and some new cabinet ideas that would fold up. So this was my office. I had this bigger office because I was kind of in charge of the project until it got switched over to the reflective monitor that George and Pat Lawler did. So it was kind of a rendering. So again, this was, you know, we were doing all this computer rendering stuff back there. And so this was called 8-Ball Universe. So it was like the follow-up to 8-Ball Deluxe, futuristic. But there it stopped. At month 5.5, it switched over to the other design. And then we got Star Wars. So we did a dog and pony show. And this was kind of like nobody was sure if it was going to work. George and Pat's concept was pretty cool. But it wasn't really a game. So Cameron basically spent, you know, I think we did this in like under 2 weeks, very quickly. We built one mode, and we built a full play field. This cabinet is made of foam core. So on the other side of it is nothing. There's nothing there. And the idea was that people were coming in to look at the game, you know, into the office, and this is kind of exactly what they saw. And we had one mode with Darth Vader's ship going, and there's video of it somewhere. Somebody filmed it. It was pretty cool. But it gave us the money to go, oh, there's a little better shot. So I had to design this whole other play field. Actually, it's a pretty good play field. And we had Darth Vader's ship, and we had this thing that you shoot into, and some, we had a ramp up here that would go in, it would capture the ball. So everybody knew, hey, this is gonna be, you know, this is gonna be pretty cool. And then we moved along to the regular Star Wars. So here's a playfield that you know can actually make, because the other playfield had too much stuff on it. And the neat thing about this playfield is, you know, some designers, you know, every designer is a different style, and some put a lot of shots, you know, all the way across, all the way across the top of the game. And I'm a little bit old school. I like to widen the shots up because I want kids to play my games. I want, you know, girls, women to play the games, guys, you know, wizards to play the game that are really good. So Star Wars, we had this big argument about the number of shots and the size of the, you know, the width of everything. But if you look at this game, it's... you know, it's very much... Actually, the first one had a spinner, too. It had a spinning disc. And these big hot dogs from Flash. Steve Ritchie did this game called Flash with these big bolts that would light up. And again, from my how I see pinball, you know, my filter, those things I love in games, and I thought they were really, you know, just very original, very creative. You know, having a lamp turn on a thing, like, you know, how simple can you get? But it's so important. So I try and copy those or use them in my games. So we had kind of power flippers and these power kind of bars that would light up and stuff. But really, Star Wars is Captain Fantastic. So if you look at the layout and the shots and the feel, it plays very similar to Captain Fantastic. Again, a game that I played that influenced me as a kid. And we took the Star Wars game to a Star Wars show, and we had, you know, 1,000 people play the game. And we had like 5-year-old kids playing Star Wars, making all the ramp shots and doing everything. And everybody was kind of like, you know, that was cool that these 5-year-old kids are making, you know, Qui-Gon's watch go and things like that. And Cameron, he said he enjoyed building games more than programming. So he would always come down. And again, because we were kind of like quality nuts, you know, you can't make a pinball game and put it out and have it break instantly. You know, the people should be fired who work on a game like that. It should not ever happen. So in this case, we would basically, the first maybe 3 or 4 games, these are prototypes, Cameron and I would fasten every single part to the game and then make notes. This bracket doesn't fit. The screw's not the right size. This post is too short. And then report all that stuff back to Jack if he wasn't there, or I would go change my CAD drawings because we didn't want the games kind of going out and having any trouble. So what's my nickname? Little trivia. Any ideas? The Dirt Devil. So when we were doing Star Wars, it was kind of like everyone was under a lot of pressure. So, you know, we did kind of a lot of kooky stuff. And it was in the game for about a minute. So I think Greg Ferrari says, we should put that in the game. So we put it in the game. And it was like too big. So we took it out. But for Star Wars, we were kind of in the secret room. And it was like locked off from the rest of the company. We had our own server. We had a cabinet, we had to lock stuff in at night, and that was all mandated by Lucasfilm to work on their project. We all had to sign these security agreements. It was a little nutty. Oh, here's one of the 5-year-old wizards. So this kid's like making all the shots, and he didn't know how to plunge the ball. He didn't know how to do that. He could do everything else except he didn't know how to plunge the ball. So we were like amazed. There's Greg goofing around. So. We're not sure. I think he just put the decal on so he's licking it or something. And then pinball kind of closed, and I went to work for ICE for a little bit. John Trudeau went there. They're going to start a pinball program. They got pretty close, but they got cold feet. And I've been in and out of the toy game, and I went to work for this company called Zizzle. And Roger Schiffman was a gentleman who created the Furby, and we had known him from Star Wars, the Star Wars work. And then I called him up, and I sent him a drawing of a futuristic pinball game. And they were working on a home pinball game, which I didn't know at the time. So they hired me instantly, and they said, we want you to work on this pinball game. And we built this game for 4-year-olds. 4-year-olds are wizards, too. So this is this was Pinball Expo maybe 5 years ago. We were set up at the other hotel, and we had 4 or 6 games. We had a kids' tournament. We had shirts we gave out. And this whole day, you know, this is your player all day. And people on RGP would give me flack, you know, oh, the flippers aren't right, and this and that. And it's like, are you crazy? The game is built for kids. It's $199. It has a wood play field, wood cabinets, steel legs, all LED lighting. It has ramps, spinners, you know. And it's not built for you. It's built for 5-year-old kids. And you could pick it up. So if you know, if you can put it in the kid's room and move it, and it was great. And it was very successful. Here's a prototype. So again, one of my foam models, foam core and different parts. And this one was shooting. We had the bumpers working. And in this case, we would send this to China, because China was doing the engineering along with our CAD data and SolidWorks data. But again, I always build these foam things to correct scale to kind of get a feel. And all opinions count. So this is one of the great things I learned working at WMS, that I want people to come play my game. And I want them to tell me if it's good, or you know, and Steve Ritchie, you know, told me, you know, the S word. If three people tell you it sucks, and you need to change it. And in this case, we had everybody from the company play our little Zizzle game and get feedback. And the CFO, Al, was the ramp champ. He could make the ramps the most. So he said, "I'm not going to play your game." It's like, you're the perfect guy to play the game. So, in this case, the Zizzle games were all done in 3D CAD. So one big model. And we would send that off to China or to Hong Kong, our office, and then it would go into Pro-E, and then from Pro-E, they cut steel to make tooling. These are all injection molded. And this game, in production, we were making 9,000 games a week. Our factory had 500 injection molding machines in this factory. It was just ginormous. You know, that's a word. So everything had to work. And, you know, and I learned a lot of my SolidWorks stuff from Dr. Flash, from John Trudeau. At ICE, we did everything in SolidWorks. We built these huge things in SolidWorks. It was pretty cool. So he really helped me a lot. And again, we built lots of breadboards, lots of samples. So again, if you're building a pinball machine, and we're having trouble with the bumpers and with the slingshots. So we built these different models and different things. And again, it's much easier for me to fix this now than make a game in production and then have problems with it later once I've made, you know, 30,000 or 90,000 of these games. So we would do tons of breadboarding like this. So from the SolidWorks, they make a prototype. And then from the prototype, this is like a finished, works-like, looks-like model, which is kind of toy vernacular. This is perfect. The paint on this, there's not one hair. It's all decaled. It's fully lighted. And then that would go, the marketing guys would take that, you know, the Toys R Us or whatever to make a sales call. And then we do, lots of films after. We get the production parts down. In the toy business, it's high volume and low cost, so you have to injection mold everything. There's no handwork. So all the slingshots and wire forms, it's all done in the machine. And actually, this was pretty cool, kind of an LED kind of ball target thing, which we took out, but it's pretty cool. We had to do all our new inserts and things like that. We created a new playfield process for creating the artwork on the wood, and we created a special PVC rubber for the rubbers. These games do not get dirty. We have black rubbers on them, and it took us about 3 months to formulate this rubber. And you can look at a Zizzle game like 3-4 years, you know, after you've played it, and there's not one speck of dirt on the playfield. There's no ball tracks. There's nothing. So it kind of helped us, because again, for toys, you know, toys don't really get dirty. They just, you know, kind of the batteries go out. So assembly, again, we couldn't have a lot of coils, so we had to have one coil for the slingshots. Here's all the LED lighting and all the inserts. We had a special pattern that we designed for the LED, for the inserts to disperse the light. And we had this gargantuan factory. It was real hard to take pictures. They don't like you taking pictures. So we had to sneak someone in to take pictures to do this. And it was interesting here, they would build the game first, and then the decals would go on last. We decaled the cabinets. So it's pretty cool. But they would build the whole game first and then decal it last and then put it in the box. Predominantly women in the factories in China for the most part. So. Here's a quality area. They don't test every game. There's too many games per week. So they would pull maybe every 100 games and check it, pull the next 100. So the Zizzle games, and I'll send you the code if everybody wants, it has a test, like a test procedure in it. You got to pull the glass off and hold, you know, the buttons, the combination on the playfield. It goes into test mode. And you can test all the coils and lights, just like a real pinball game. And they use that here. So this would be, in this case, starting a day's production, you know, game 100, you know, game 200, game 300. They, you know, every 100 or 200 games, they pull one off the line to test it. Because they can't test every game because the line is moving too fast. They can't do it.
And again, all LED lighting, back box. And the cool thing is, the bill of material for that game is the same cost as a piece of wood that pinball manufacturers pay for now. So what they pay just for their piece of wood with the silk screen on it, that's our whole bill of material for this game. So we were able to leverage our engineering, you know, like our pinball ideas, work with the engineers over there, and come up with processes, methods, ways to tool parts, ways to save in production. So we're pretty proud of that. And the game was feature-rich. Again, it's a home game for kids. It's not supposed to be, you know, like Transformers. It's just a home game for kids. But it had a lot of, you know, it had a lot of stuff. And we had to keep the same design, because that's how we get the cost down. We can't retool for every game. You can retheme them. So in the toy business, you'll see pinball games that look the same, but like have the same play, but the artwork is different. And then we're at home shopping. This guy's really good. We trained him to play to play again. Oh, I forgot I'd tell. I got two quick videos. So.
It is.
Bill Duggan joins us next here at HSN with the coolest.
So Bill, we trained about the game. He came.
This is the real deal. This is a 3/4 scale of an authentic pinball machine. It's got the wood, it's got the plastic, it's got the steel, it's got the plungers, it's got everything that you would normally get in a large scale, full size pinball machine, but you're getting it in the 3/4 size. You're getting all the lights, all the bells and whistles, solid wood construction.
Nice.
They haven't chintzed out on anything. You're getting great legs that are gonna solid steel, you have the tilt functions, and you're gonna have hours of fun and entertainment and play.
You know,
it's
you
great.
Said that the.
So we're in Home Shopping Network, I think 3 times, and it was pretty cool. I almost got to go on. I was real close to go on, but I didn't. And then the last game we did was the Atari Arcade Classics. We were working with Atari doing handheld games, and then we said, you know, we should do a pinball game. Actually, this was the best sizzle game that didn't get made. It turned out to be a beautiful game. The artwork was beautiful, and we had Asteroids and Centipede and all of that stuff. And we made a few prototypes, and then that was it. There was no more demand. Like, nobody was buying them anymore, so. And that's a toy business. And today, you know, we all miss WMS. It was a great place. And when you look back, they really let us do what we wanted to do. They trusted us that we knew how to make pinball and earn money and make money for our customers and for the company. It was a really wonderful place, even though at the time, you know, we'd kind of complain about stuff. But today, I do a lot of interactive brand work. So I'm a designer. And these are some of the companies or brands that I've done work. So I've, you know, worked with Stan Lee and Marvel, and you know, we did all the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, a lot of stuff for Disney, a lot of stuff for Apple, Sesame Street. So I've had a lot of experience at a different level, different than the pinball business. And we develop games. I have a small interactive company. We do iPhone and iPad games for kids. Of course, pinball. Here's Pinball Roo. It's like a pinball game for the iPad, and the kids count, the balls come out, and then they hit the bumpers and things like that. Pretty cool. But a pinball designer never stops thinking about pinball. Because, you know, that's my inner animal spirit. I'm looking for the banana split, you know. And all pinball designers have this kind of weird thing that they're always tinkering and building things. And so I did a pinball scrapbook, which is just the first. It's kind of an iPad encyclopedia book to get started. And then, of course, well, we have to do a real iPhone pinball game. There are a lot of them made. But again, you know, we did Pinball Wizard about 2.5 years ago, which seems like a long time ago, but in the iPhone world, it's like kind of the beginning of it, because that whole, you know, that whole thing is just all brand new. We got it registered U.S. and Patent Trademark Office, so I own the Pinball Wizard trademark, which is pretty cool. And, of course, we built an app for it. And we did 2 things different with this app, right? Maybe 3 things. First thing we did is we built the game to fit the screen kind of geography. A lot of the other games were tilted and they moved and things like that. Of course, we connected it to Facebook. So if you get a score, it goes up on Facebook. We have a design mode where you can move the bumpers and things around and then go back to play, and you can play your kind of redesigned game. But the biggest thing we did was we added a high score leaderboard. So when you get a high score, it keeps it locally on your device, but you can also push it out to the server, to the world server. And it's probably a little more than that now, but you know, well over 100,000 people
playing this pinball game. And it's not the best pinball game. There's, you know, there's a lot of Pinball HD, and there's a lot of other ones that are really good. And we get about 50,000 players monthly. We have this high scoreboard. So if you go to Pinball Wizard, and you'll see the scores will get deleted. I'm the guy deleting the scores. So, and we have players all over the world, Italy, France, you know, Finland, Japan, Korea. And the neat thing is these aren't people from kind of like our community, meaning some are, but they're all the other people in the world that play pinball. So here we have, you know, Pinball Expo, we have people that come, and we have customers that buy pinball now, they buy new pinball on the box, collectors. But so all those people are kind of everybody else. And then I'm thinking, well, what if we connect these two worlds together? So I have 125,000 people here playing my game, and if I make you know, a new run of a pinball game today sells 100, 200, 400, 500. I mean, it doesn't sell a whole lot, not like the old days. So it was kind of like, it's been bugging me. And so what if we made a game that's based on the app? And so this is kind of something I've been working on for a while. And it just, and again, because, you know, I'm the hungry squirrel, you never stop, you know, you never stop designing pinball. But working in mobile and doing iPhone, iPad stuff, it's instantaneous. So you get your user feedback right away. You get your revenue right away. You know, you get paid right away. And people are interacting with your product, you know, right away. And they give you feedback right away. It's real, you know, it's just a whole different business model than what everybody's used to from, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. And a lot of people are having trouble with that. They're stuck in the old business model. They're still trying to sell their thing. But everybody else is here. You know, they sold 5 million iPhone 3GSs last week, on last Friday. Or not, yeah, so a week ago this Friday, was Steve Jobs Day. So they sold 5 million iPhone, or 4GSs a week ago Friday, one day, or, you know, 2 days. So now there's 5 million new customers for some type of game. Might be pinball, might be, you know, Angry Birds, or, you know, whatever it might be. And then what if these two things can talk to each other? What if the iPhone app can talk to the pinball game? So someone will go, there'll be a Pinball Wizard, a real game that's built, and you're kind of walking along, you have your, you know, your iPhone, and they begin to talk to each other. And so this has really been stuck in my brain, this thing, you know, the nut. How do I make the banana split out of the nut? And you know, everybody has ideas, but, you know, making those ideas real is really hard. It takes a lot of time. And so I've been kind of working on this. This is a digital version. It's on a large screen. So starting to take it over, put it on a big screen, and, you know, start to play with it. So then I kind of made this company, created this company called Pinball Inventor. Because I'm at home, I'm working on this stuff, and I meet with, you know, other people, but I'm, you know, basically kind of out of the industry, you know, not really doing any work for anyone else. But I still have all these great ideas. I think I have the best ideas. And they're too good to just let them sit and kind of go away into nothing. So being the hungry squirrel, you know, I'm an opportunist. I'm trying to get this stuff going. And so I started this, and all of a sudden I had this flood of people wanting to get involved. Other programmers, other people pinball, other pinball people. People from all over the world that I've met from the mobile space. And it was, it kind of like took me by surprise a little bit. You know, kind of like, how do you work with all of this? But again, that's the business model, or that's like the social model we live in now. It's this kind of, the whole world is kind of, you know, in the palm of your hand instantly. So what are you going to do with that power? It kind of is like that. You know, and then I decided, well, am I going to do this without Jack? Because, you know, doing pinball, your team, and I got to work with the best artists, programmers. And we were a team. We worked together. It wasn't like me telling, well, maybe sometimes I told him what to do. But, you know, we worked as a team. And so then for the longest time, you know, I'm not really interested in doing any more pinball. I'm done. I've done games and, you know, whatever. And then, you know, Jack passed away about 2 months ago. And I thought, you know, I'm going to kind of ramp this up a little bit. And so that's what I've been doing. So I'm kind of starting to build that new... the new world in between the mobile world and the current pinball world, that they can come together and bring those people.
And to do that, you know, we need ideas, obviously, new thinking, new technology. We have this whole social thing, which is much different now. And so with the iPhone, for example, I have 125,000 loyal customers that I can talk to today, tomorrow, whenever I want to, and tell them what I'm doing, because I'm on their device right now. And I'm talking to them directly. It's not I'm going in a magazine. I'm not putting a magazine ad in hoping somebody will see the magazine ad and then hopefully, you know, they will call to get information. You know, my phone will make a sound and they'll look at it, oh, update from Pinball Wizard or, you know, update from Pinball Inventor or whatever it might be. Or coupon. Might be a coupon for something. Might be a tournament coming up, whatever it might be. So this is all different. This whole thing is just been exploded into this new kind of way that we're still understanding how it works. Obviously, we need a new pinball verve, meaning, you know, pinball's supposed to be fun. If you're designing pinball and everybody's fighting, arguing, or having someone tell them what to do, you know, design it this way, well, it's no fun. And you're not going to make good pinball because that energy is going to get into the game, and it's eventually going to kind of bring down the game. You're going to have problems. So, and new people. So when I started, I had senior designers, older designers, mentor me. You know, Greg Kamik, Jim Patla, Steve Ritchie. You know, Steve Ritchie is probably the most influential before I knew him. And when I worked at WMS, he would come in and shut the door, and he'd give me some pointers on stuff and totally changed how I design games. So he was bold enough to pass along the knowledge to me, you know, the new guy. And he did. So what I'm trying to do is work with new people. So I'm working with artists. That, you know, the guys I work with are from Marvel for the games we're doing, like for Magic Girl and that. And they've never done a pinball machine. They've done comic books and shows and all, but they've never done a pinball machine. So I'm giving them all my knowledge. How do you compose a pinball backlash? Or how do you design art around mechanisms? You know, things like that. And from it, I get a new energy, and then we started working on Magic Girl. So Magic Girl was being worked on in my studio, and it was just a prototype. It was full size, all built in foam. And I had a gentleman come to my house, and he was picking up some Circus Voltaire posters. And he goes, like, what's that? And I said, well, it's a game I'm working on, and we're looking at it. And he goes, what are you going to do with it? And I go, you know, I'm not sure. I haven't thought that far ahead. Because I'm out of the business, and I, you know, obviously I don't have the money to set up a pinball manufacturing plant. And I said, you know, I'm not sure, but it's full of really good ideas. It needs to be built. And he says, well, how much do you think it'll be? And I, you know, I told him, well, it's going to be, you know, X dollars. And he goes, well, I'll buy one. So he wrote me a check right there for game number one. And he works in the automotive business in Detroit or outside Detroit. So he helped me just with some business advice, how to get started, how to talk to people, how to find out if anybody's really interested in buying your new game. And so we put it up on, it kind of leaked out on RGP. We're trying to get Jim Shelberg involved, and it got real kind of crazy real quick. And it kind of leaked out on, I think Thursday night. It was like a Thursday night on RGP. And we had the website set up already. We had the links to purchase. We had information. We had what imagery. We told people what it is. You know, hand-drawn artwork. If you like what I've done before, you'll like this game. No Photoshop, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, I can't do it without your support, basically. So in 2 days, we sold 40 games in 2 days. All online, all viral, without meeting anyone, without anybody seeing anything about the game. Only a belief. They believed in this game that it couldn't be done. We're not making 40, you know. Well, we're making a much smaller amount. This is its first game, so we have a lot of issues because everything's new, everything's ground up. But the main thing was the pinball community, you know, they want a new groove. They want some new action. They want some new ideas. They want some new inspiration, new designs. They just want something new. And that's what everybody told me. And they said, you know, that's why we're buying your game. People are waiting to buy the second game. They have no idea what it is. And we're getting all sorts of support, again, from grassroots, people wanting to get involved. So when we're ready to build Magic Girl, you know, we already have a crew lined up. People are going to come in from different parts of the country and from Europe, and we're all going to work together. And you know, with me guiding them, we're going to hand build these games in a, you know, small in a small build. And I'm going to show them how we build whitewoods, how we check for things, how we check for brackets, how things should work, how we shoot a whitewood. Whitewoods usually have trouble shooting them. And then when you get to a screenplay filled with clear coat, usually they shoot much different than the whitewoods. So our whitewoods for here, we're getting them clear coated. You know, we're getting all our whitewoods clear coated to start because the ball is faster. So then we can kind of eliminate any issues later on because we'll be shooting a fast play field like from the get-go from that. And then the main thing, you know, that I need or you know, how this works back and forth is obviously support. So we're trying to use, you know, everything is made in the USA. So I'm paying more money to have brackets made or cabinet made or whatever it might be, artwork drawn. And so the money I'm getting from my customers or from people that support my project are going to help other families in the USA and Canada, you know, but generally it's not going to some country way far away for me to buy a cheap bracket. So if I can buy a, we got our first shipment of brackets in this week, 304 stainless, everything is in 304 stainless, beautiful, all the brackets. So I'm paying, say, you know, $3 more per bracket, but it's being made, you know, in the USA, and it's supporting a family, another family, or, you know, another person that way. So that's really good. You know, it makes me feel good. It makes everybody else feel good. And it's very much a grassroots movement, meaning, you know, people are coming up to me all the time to talk. How can I get involved? What can I do? You know, and so it's kind of neat because we don't have, like, a monkey on our back telling us what to do. We're starting to get that fun and get it back into pinball, and try and make some good games and try and redesign out kind of like the stuff that doesn't work and be more clever and put in the stuff that does work. But ultimately for pinball, you know, it comes down to the design and the play field. So you can have a really beautiful cabinet and wonderful cabling inside the game but you know, people don't see any of that. All they see is the play field. And maybe the, you know, dot matrix or LCD screen, you know, whatever it might be. But people see that. So in this case, you know, the stops are pulled out. It's going to be a hyper-creative design. There'll be things on there that people have never seen, new inventions, new ideas, new methods, but still pinball. And a lot of those things we're protecting with patents applied, some we're finishing up. And some of the stuff is pretty cool. And again, all it is to make a fun pinball game. It's not, I want to be cool. You know, I made Circus Voltaire, so, you know, what else do I need to do? I don't need to do anything else. Or my team made Circus Voltaire, but I didn't do it by myself. So I'm trying to get back to the way things used to be when people would say, you know, Jim Patlett used to say, you can do whatever you want. You know, and that wasn't quite true, but it was pretty true. And so I think we can still do that. There's still room to do that, and I can build a really wonderful new mechanism cheaply or inexpensively that's really cool on a game. Doesn't have to be a $50 motor doing something that I've already seen in four other games. It is possible, but it's hard to do. You know, I really gotta, you know, put on my squirrel hat and kind of figure that out. Everything is being rethought. So pretty well because it is ground up, every single bracket I have to look at, every part. So I get to rethink it. Well, is that the best way? Cabling, rethink cabling. Are there other things you can do? And again, and I mentioned new, and I just put young people because, you know, I'm getting older. So, but trying to bring people in that haven't done pinball, so in software or in art or hardware or, you know, whatever it might be, to pass along what I know, my knowledge. To say, look, you know, I had guys that taught me all this stuff, you know, 20 years ago, and right now it's, you know, I'm at home, it's not going anywhere, so I need to pass this along to other people too. And hopefully they'll pick it up, they'll get the verve, they'll get the energy, and then maybe they'll kind of be working at the new pinball companies kind of in the future, or making new pinball in the future. So here's one thing we started. So we made this, I made two t-shirts. The owner, you might see people walking around with like a purpley Magic Girl t-shirt. So those are the owners. So the owners get this special t-shirt. And it's only a t-shirt, but I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of cool. And then I was talking to Jim Shellberg, and I said, you know, I've always wanted to do a shirt, a Ping Game Journal shirt. So Jim sent me his logo, and we made these last week. We did them real quick, and we had them printed locally.
And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like a pinball expo. Next year we'll do like a pinball expo shirt with Rob's logo. We didn't do it. Just kind of a Magic Girl shirt, just to kind of be kind of fun. In this case, all the money for these, it's going to Spina Bifida Research. So I'm losing a lot of money on these shirts to sell them for $10, but you know, that's okay. But we put the QR tag on. So for mobile, we've been doing a lot of work with digital recognizers, scanners, things like that. You have an app that you know you can scan something. So the QR tag is really interesting because it's we can make an app. So there's a Magic Girl app that we have. It's not at iTunes yet, but and basically it has game information, you know, designers, photos. It links you to the Magic Girl website, but it has a built-in QR reader that you can use from that. And the QR code's great because you can pass information to your user or to the mobile user, and to start the game talking to the mobile piece and the mobile piece talking to the game. In this case, some ideas for the player, obviously we'd have it on the rule card. Nobody reads pinball rules, and maybe the rule set's, 6 pages long, but they can scan it, and then it'll be on their app, and they can take that home and read it later. Or for the collector, different parts of the game will have a different QR tag. The playfield will have a different one, so when you scan that, it'll tell you how the playfield is made, or inside of the cabinet. And there's just so much that you can do, and this takes 1 second, for me to scan that, and because everybody's kind of living in a faster world, so we're starting to think of more ideas like this and to start to connect that, and it's probably going to take more than me, obviously. I mean, I may be starting, but hopefully more people get involved in what I'm doing. And obviously much smarter than I am, and to start to kind of build these new bridges from the mobile world, which 5 million iPhone 4GS users Friday, well, I want them to play pinball. So, how can we, crack that nut, kind of so to speak. So that's kind of, how I got started in pinball and what I've been doing. And again, pinball designers, at least the ones that I know, they're always making pinball. So when you're doing peanut butter and jelly, you're spreading it like flippers, and when you're cutting sandwiches, they look like thumper bumpers, and it's kind of real silly like that. So I'll just kind of keep moving along and hopefully get people involved that want to, kind of get into something that's exciting and new, and we have kind of less shackles on us to design, to kind of move out and do that. So we have a few minutes left for questions. If anybody has a question. Yes, sir.
For the notion of the game that exists in some kind of connected form between the iPhone version and the physical version, it would seem that is probably need a new kind of pinball operator to put that out in a new kind of pinball location, of which there are some.
Right.
Have you given thought to that aspect of it? Like, what you would expect?
You're on the team, you have a shirt, so. No, but see, that's a great question. Again, something that was never really, a new type of pinball operator. Yeah. I've never heard that before, but, that's.
People that have game rooms where the primary draw is they want to say, this is a world-class pinball location, we expect people to travel up to 250 miles to play pinball in our location.
Right, right.
Instead of the usual 10 miles.
Yep. No, that's a good question. And that would go on the list of how do we look at this, or right? Yeah, and I think there's one game. There's an iPhone game called Fruit Ninja, and it's there's guys in Montreal that have made like a video game out of it. So they're one of the new breed of companies that they're forgetting the whole old model of the video game business, and they're taking apps, successful iPhone apps, and making new type of games, new cabinet designs, for the new operator. So they're, they're just in a whole different area of communication with all different people. So.
How many physical games do you get? I mean,
I can't say, but I will say if you counted a pinball game in a wood cabinet with solenoids and metal legs and electronic system, it's without a doubt the largest pinball run ever in history. So it was phenomenally huge.
So high blood pressure. So.
You mentioned early in the presentation that Captain Fantastic was everywhere.
Yes.
1,000 of them. And you also mentioned about 125,000 users that responded. What number of games would you like to see built? You would imagine early some future game, but what number would you like to see out there?
I think it's actually Mike and I were talking today. Pinball kind of has two problems because you need to address operators or the new operator because they still need to earn money on location. And then we have this collector market. And then we have what I call the new pinball owner. It's basically it might be someone in their 20s. Maybe their dad played pinball. Maybe they just got their first job in an apartment. They have room for a pinball. So it's kind of like we have these different customers. But then the arcade, the street location arcade and the collector home market, they've kind of flipped over now, that the arcade now is kind of the lower denominator and the collector home arcade is kind of number one. So I think it's put kind of a steel, you know, wrench into everything, that business model from 10 years ago or, you know, is kind of not there anymore. So it needs to be kind of all rethought. What is the new, you know, who's the new pinball person? But I kind of see three. I got a lot of people that want to get their first game. Obviously, collectors. And then the operators are kind of dying because the games are making $75 a week and they have to pay $5,000 for a game. The old days, we would pay for a game in 6 to 8 weeks. So we buy a KISS game or Flash, and 6 to 8 weeks would be paid off. The rest is gravy money. Now it might take them 2 years to pay a game off. So the operator needs to be addressed, which that's what the Fruit Ninja guys are doing in Montreal. I think it's Adrenaline Amusements. They have this beautiful game, and you touch it, and it's fruit, but it's a video game. But it's really well done. So it earns very well. No more questions? Okay, one more. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your career?
Yeah, there's too much stuff for the. So next one, all. Tails, again, at the time, when you finish a game, we were at WMS, you had to go back with your team, and you had to go through themes. Roger Sharp was head of licensing, so he would have his list of movies. This movie's coming out, Star Trek's coming out, The Shadow, and then we would go through his list, and if nothing really jumped out, then we would have to do an original theme. And at that time, I think Disney Aladdin was kind of big, and nobody had done kind of like an Aladdin's Castle type game in a while. So when I do games, I always try and fit a theme that hasn't been done in a while. So that's how, you know, the Magic game came up. No one had done a Magic game in 20 years. So then Tales Arabian Nights was basically the adult version of Aladdin. And then we bought the books. There's a series of translated books, 1001 Nights, and it's, you know, 6 or 8 giant books of magic genies and all this. It's crazy, very violent stuff. And we read all that, and it was like, wow, this would make a really good game. So we just kind of, you know, moved it along from there. And again, because I'm kind of this retro future guy, we went back into the past. So the bonus count on Arabian Nights, can anyone tell me what game that's from in the 70s? Anybody? Yeah?
Playboy.
So Jim Patlas Playboy. Do 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 do. So I copied that over. We made the song. The spinning disc was from Triple Action Steve Kordak. We went to Foremost Plastic, the vendor. They had the tool on the shelf from, you know, 30 years. So we paid zero for tooling. They cleaned the tool up. So I saved the company, you know, $15,000-$20,000 on a tool. And, you know, kind of a lot of things like that. The vanishing magnet was from World Cup, which was from Alice in Wonderland. Had the vanish ball. We had it on World Cup for a while. You don't have vanishing balls in soccer, so we took it off. And then it got on to Arabian Nights. So it's kind of an evolution of. But, you know, the theme, picking a really good theme is like the most important design decision. So if you have a bad theme to start, the game's only going to be bad. You can't fix it. So, oh, and I guess the spikes. We had the spikes. So part of inventing was you had to create these gimmicks and things that were cool. So the first spike assembly was a board with nails, real nails. And like Ken and Neil, they're the guys that kind of were in charge of WMS. They came in from lunch, and they're looking at the game. And then I think Louis Koziaris was playing, and I was over on the side with my hot wire hooked to the transformer. And then when the ball went in the out lane, I did the wires, and the spark went, and the nails came up under the play field and grabbed the ball, and it scared them. They went like, whoa, what was that? And I said, well, that's the ball save. And the first thing he said was, well, you can't have real nails in the game like that. So it was kind of funny. But we would have to prototype stuff like that early on because everybody had to kind of agree, okay, we can do that, or that looks too expensive. So we did a lot of prototyping in foam and kind of doing it that way. Okay, well, I think time is up, so thanks very much for coming.